From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. 8 shark attacks so far this season off the North Carolina coast, and summer isn't even half over. It's a record-setting number and a chilling one for most people. There's no getting around the primal fear that sharks seem to trigger in humans. Time magazine recently confirmed this in a study by showing viewers scientific information about sharks and explaining that up to 100 million sharks are killed by humans each year. Fewer than 5 people are killed by sharks annually. Based on these statistics, according to Time, you're far more likely to die from a bee sting or the flu than to be killed by a shark. The study showed that information had no impact on viewers' emotional reactions to scary videos of sharks. Today, we're going to explore the questions that continue to swirl around this topic, particularly after 4 of the 8 attacks this year in North Carolina ended in very serious injuries, with 2 young people losing parts of their arms. Joining us today to help sort out the hysteria from the facts are 2 shark experts. With us by phone is one of the most interviewed shark experts in the country lately. George Burgess is the director of the Florida Program for Shark Research and the International Shark Attack File, both of which are based in the University of Florida's Museum of Natural History. George Burgess, welcome to Coastline.
Nice to be with you.
Chuck Bangley is a PhD candidate in coastal resource management at East Carolina University, currently working on a shark habitat selection study. Chuck Bangley, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And you are invited to join the conversation. Do you have a question about sharks or shark safety? Have the recent attacks affected your behavior at the beach? Give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send your comments or questions to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. George Burgess, why are unprovoked shark attacks on the rise?
Well, the bottom line, after we discuss a series of factors that might contribute, is fundamentally that there's more humans in the water. And each year, of course, the human population grows worldwide, and with it comes a concurrent increase in the number of people visiting the sea. And, of course, there's been a real interest in aquatic sports, active aquatic sports that has grown over the years, such as surfing and sailboarding and scuba diving and things like that. And so not only are we putting more people in the water, we're doing more provocative things in areas where sharks live.
And Chuck Bangley, what are some of the factors that might be contributing to the spate of shark attacks that we've been seeing off the coast of North Carolina this season?
Well, specifically in North Carolina, the heat wave that we had in mid-June happened to coincide with when everybody got out for summer vacation, when everybody got out of school. So you had kind of a higher number of people than average going to the beaches. I mean, I certainly did. It was over 100 degrees out. On top of that, we have an annual migration of marine species that occurs off in North Carolina from about May to June. And it's not just sharks. It's things like sea turtles, schools of menhaden, large fish. Some sea mammals are involved, and that's normal. That occurs every year. The heat wave may have caused that to be a little bit more compressed than normal, but the migration in and of itself is a normal event.
Are warmer waters contributing to the fact that we've seen more shark activity?
What we found over the course of researching how sharks use habitat here in North Carolina is that temperature certainly seems to be associated with when some species are present. There's kind of a colder water shark community and a warmer water shark community that occur off North Carolina. And the colder water sharks tend to be here in the winter, and they're out of here by about May. And then the warmer water sharks move up from places like Florida and the Caribbean in about May and June, and they're part of that big northward migration. Some of those sharks will stay here for the entire summer. Others will travel as far north as Cape Cod. So temperature certainly seems to cue sharks arriving in the area, and an abnormal kind of increase in temperature like we had in June may trigger some of them to show up earlier.
George Burgess, when we're looking at the numbers, and you've tracked and compiled data on shark attacks from as far back as 1935 through last year, has North Carolina broken a record?
Well, it has, and I might point out that 1935 was the first verified shark attack in North Carolina. We actually have investigations worldwide back to the mid-1500s. So that was the first time we saw one in North Carolina, and in fact, the eight that we've had so far this year in North Carolina surpasses the annual high of five, which occurred several years ago. So this obviously is a banner year, if you will, for shark bites in North Carolina.
And clearly you've been following the North Carolina shark attacks. Are there common threads in these attacks? Are there things that you can point to that say, you know, it's the time of day, or it has to do with the activity that the person was engaging in, or is there anything to take from this?
Well, the attacks occurred, of course, in a discreet area, which is the actual area that we as humans enter most often anywhere in the world, which is the waters at a depth of 6 feet or less. And the reason why we're so many people there is because we can't swim underwater, we can't breathe underwater, so we got to keep our head above water. So that's where people enter the water, and it's, of course, where interactions with sharks that therefore occur the most. That said, when we're in the water, we're uniquely ungraceful. as we attempt to swim or wade or whatever we're doing, we're making a racket. And those irregular movements are particularly attractive to sharks, which are looking for the infirm, the injured, any sign of weakness in a prey item that they can take advantage of. And so, of course, under conditions of poor visibility, such as we see in the surf, sharks need to make quick decisions on things, and they grab at splashes. And sometimes, unfortunately, those splashes are a foot or an arm, and of course, we have an attack. In the case of several of these attacks, though, one common thread is that it was a larger shark. In North Carolina, at this time of year, that pretty much means bull shark or tiger shark. Judging by the injuries and the types of the styles of attacks, several of these no doubt were done by bull sharks.
Of course, sharks can't read state boundary signs, and we've been seeing all of this off the coast of North Carolina. Is there a reasonable explanation for why this hasn't been happening so much just to our north or south in Virginia or South Carolina?
Of course, you've hit on a hugely important point, especially from a conservation standpoint, and that is that these are highly migratory animals. They don't follow geopolitical lines, and so, of course, when we're looking to do conservation, that really comes into play. That said, we have had a number of incidents so far in South Carolina this year. We've had four already, which is about what we normally get in a year in South Carolina. So there's been a activity in both of the Carolinas, and I think it follows those environmental variables. I think as the waters have warmed from south to north, the sharks, which are following those isotherms, as we call it, the common temperatures as they move north, have come into the Carolina waters, and of course, many of their food fishes and so forth also are coming, and others are to be found. And so we've sort of seen a south to north movement on the attacks. That said, we very likely will have an attack sooner or later this summer. North of North Carolina. We had one in Delaware last year, which is a very uncommon place to have them. And we very likely could have a bite on the New Jersey coast before the summer's over. We have to just simply follow that warming water as it goes north.
And George Burgess of the International Shark Attack File at the University of Florida, that Delaware attack, that happened during the summer last year.
That's right.
And tell us again why that's so unusual off the coast
of
Delaware.
Well, first of all, Delaware is a tiny little state, so it's hard to throw a dart and hit Delaware if you're a shark, so to speak. So that's a toughie. But that said, there's not as many people, of course, going in the water as Delaware as there is in North Carolina, because there's a lot less beaches and, and also there's less opportunity. But it's farther north, and it's in you know, somewhat cooler waters. It takes a while for those waters to get warm. And the same thing goes up the coastline all the way up to Long Island and in southern New England. Someone just sent me an email yesterday of a shark that was caught off of the south coast of Long Island. It was a little sandbar shark. You know, that's early for a sandbar shark to be found off there as well. So it's clear that this unseasonably warm temperatures is having an effect all the way up the coastline.
Chuck Bangley from East Carolina University, you've been taking a look at shark habitat selection, why sharks go to certain areas. Are there places that people would be surprised that sharks frequent?
They definitely go up into the estuaries more often than I think a lot of people realize. Those sheltered areas like Pamlico Sound or Back Sound here in North Carolina, sharks will actually utilize those areas as nursery habitat, and some of the smaller species and even some of the adults will travel up there in search of food too. What we're looking at is kind of how sharks partition the habitat between species when they're within these estuaries, and we're finding that there are some that really like to hug the inlets. They like to stay in the higher salinity water. And there are others that can tolerate kind of more brackish or fresh water, and they go farther up the sounds.
And what are some of the types of sharks that you've been seeing in Pamlico Sound, for instance?
In Pamlico Sound, we have kind of six main species. It's dominated by the smooth dogfish, which is it's a small shark that's really no threat to people. They mostly eat shrimps and crabs. But we do have blacktip, sandbar sharks, and bull sharks are actually the ones that will range the farthest up the sound.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's Shark Sense today with George Burgess of the Florida Program for Shark Research and ECU shark researcher Chuck Bangley. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. And when we come back, we'll take a look at an email from Mike Rand. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio today, Chuck Bangley, shark researcher at East Carolina University. Joining us by phone, noted shark expert and director of the International Shark Attack File from Florida University, George Burgess. It's Shark Sense today, and if you'd like to ask our shark experts a question, now's your chance. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using coastlinehqr. We have an email from Mike Ran who says, are there specific steps that can be taken to prevent being bitten? I've heard of chemical and natural shark repellents, as well as wetsuits and surfboards painted with stripes that sharks will stay away from. Is there any trustworthy data to support these or other similar claims? George Burgess.
This has been an area of research ever since World War II. Of course, during World War II, lots of naval aviators and sailors went into the sea during the war, and the Navy particularly wanted to get an anti-shark measure. And in fact, the International Shark Attack File, which we curate, owes its existence to naval funding in the late 1950s that got started. That said, over the years, scientists have found a variety of things that sharks don't like, lots of chemicals that they don't like. In fact, the best thing to chase a shark away is just take a bottle of Ivory liquid soap and squirt it in their face, and they'll go running. But the problem is the sea is a big diluter, and so you would have to have literally barges full of these chemicals going in the water all the time to keep sharks away from somebody. So that's the big problem there. We've also found that electrical fields and magnetic fields can be uncomfortable for sharks, and so there's been work over the years to develop things in those areas as well. Those works continue, and there's some companies out there that have provided a personal shark protection device that produces an electric current around the person. But clearly this is not something that everybody would want to wear, and frankly doesn't need to wear. Those would be valuable, perhaps, for professionals who spend every working hour in the sea and want this extra protection, but not for your average bather. So some of these other things continue to go, and I got to tell you the truth. When we have shark attacks like this, my phones ring off the hook and my emails burn with people with ideas that they want to market, and there's no shortage of ideas.
Have you heard of any good ones recently, considering the spate of attacks?
One of my favorite ones from this time around was a woman who was concerned that, well, this is kind of an attractant story, but it tells you the nature of the interest. A woman was worried about giving her children fish oil pills because she thought that that they would be attracting the sharks if she gave those to her children. So we get stuff on the other side where people offer us solutions that are a bit off the wall.
Is that so, just to indulge us for a moment, is that so unreasonable? You ingest fish oil pills, it comes out through your pores in one way or another. It would be so diluted by the ocean that it wouldn't be traceable by a shark's nose?
Right. I think that's the take-home message. It's the same thing as for finding something that doesn't work. Finding something that does work probably is got a dilution factor, too. And even if you have that essence to do a cod liver oil on your breath or in your sweat or something, it's not likely to do much. And in fact, we get calls from women who want to know whether they should go in the water when they're menstruating. Well, liquids of any kind are attracted. Human liquids are of any kind are of interest to sharks. But again, you'd have to have every woman synchronous at the same time going out along a beach to probably attract sharks.
So you're saying in the case of a woman who's having her period, her alone, that would be unlikely to draw a shark to her. She would not be at any greater risk than, say, the man 50 yards down the beach. Is that what you're saying?
No, not probably not, just because of the dilution factor, of course. But, if you have a whole army of women that are having their period synchronously, well, then maybe you would have a problem.
Chuck Bangley, how are shark populations doing in general? Are they a protected species? Which ones are more threatened at this point?
It really depends on what kind of shark you're talking about. And North Carolina is a real hot spot for sharks. So we have sharks that can still be regularly encountered here that have really severely declined, and they're pretty rare in other states. But because North Carolina is kind of a sweet spot between major ocean currents, those species are still here.
And what are some examples of those species?
So we have the dusky shark here in North Carolina. It's a very it's a really cool looking, just classic looking shark. It's a big gray shark. They typically occur a little bit farther offshore, although their pups will swim up close to the beach, particularly in the winter. And they're very slow growing. They don't reach reproductive maturity until about 17 years old. So a dusky shark has to live for 17 years before it can basically replace itself. And because of that, they've been very severely overfished. Although there is some signs of life in that population, a recent assessment that was done actually to determine whether or not dusky sharks would be listed on the Endangered Species Act actually found that there had been an increase recently in the numbers of juveniles found, and there were even some positive signs in the adult population. So sharks here in North Carolina, their populations are not nearly as high as they were historically, but some of them are starting to bounce back from declines a little bit.
Do we see great whites around here? Most of us know about Mary Lee. This is a great white shark that has been tagged by OSearch.
Yes.
And so we know that she travels through here from time to time, but is it typical to see a great white shark off the coast of North Carolina?
We've actually they're kind of irregular visitors to the coast. We used to maintain an acoustic array with the help of North Carolina Sea Grant off of Cape Hatteras. And it turns out that Cape Hatteras is a major kind of bend in the road for everything migrating up and down the coast. So in addition to the dogfish and sandbar sharks that we would tag, we would pick up white sharks that were tagged originally in Cape Cod. And we'd usually get about a handful of them every winter. We'd get them in the kind of early winter, late fall, And then we'd see them again in the kind of late spring as they were heading back north. Some of the satellite tag white sharks have done some pretty interesting behavior off of North Carolina. There have been a few that there's a margin of error on these tags, but there have been a few that have looked like they've actually entered Pamlico Sound. And then I believe Catherine, another Osage tag shark, was cruising off the coast of Hatteras this past weekend, which is pretty unusual. They typically are off of North Carolina in the winter rather than the summer.
We have a tweet from Sarah Finn, and she says, it's interesting because she's raising an issue that we've heard about before. There's been internal debate at least one other news organization in this market regarding the use of the term attack versus bite. And we've also talked about it here and just determined for various reasons, and we'll get into this discussion, but attack has been a reasonable term to us. Unreasonable to other people. George Burgess, you are using that term in your international shark attack file at the University of North Carolina. But Sarah says it misrepresents interaction and it feeds unnecessary fear, works against conservation. How would you respond to that, George Burgess?
Two words. I'd say bah humbug. The reality is there are dog bites and there are dog attacks. There's shark bites and there's shark attacks. It's dependent on the degree of the situation. In Florida here, we have lots of shark bites in a given year. We have over 25 interactions between sharks and humans. Of those, 95% of them are bites. They're quick grabs and let goes by small sharks, resulting in little injuries. They don't deserve the word attack associated with them because they're just bites, the equivalent of a dog bite. Now, we also have a small number of attacks that occur here, which are done by larger sharks that result in larger injuries. What we've seen in North Carolina primarily have been attacks this year. They haven't been bites. They've been bites. They've been grabs by larger sharks that have done major damage. A couple of them, unfortunately, the teenagers lost their arms. There's no way in the world those are bites. They're attacks. Just like you might have a chihuahua gives you a dog bite, but a pit bull in the backyard might tear your arm off. That's an attack.
Chuck Bangley, ECU shark researcher, do you have a different feeling about that or do you share George Burgess's view?
Generally, I kind of agree with George. I use the term bites because I consider it to be a little more inclusive. We have had a few of the incidents here in North Carolina that do seem to be those kind of blacktip or spinner shark bites where they're going after a fish and they either mistake somebody's foot for it or they miss the fish and hit the foot that was behind it. And those are typically, I mean, they're not fun to go through, but those wounds are very rarely life-threatening, and the shark usually just lets go almost immediately. So I use bites to kind of include both of those and the kind of more serious kind of predatory attacks. I find bites to be, it's one syllable. but I find it to be more of a catch-all term. I kind of agree with the person sending the tweet as well that, you want to use attack if it's appropriate. You don't want to call a nip from a blacktip shark an attack necessarily because that's not even a species that targets particularly large prey. It's not going to be trying to eat a person.
Mm-hmm. A case of mistaken identity in that case.
Yes, and even with some of the larger sharks, a lot of the time it's a bite and release kind of situation. Unfortunately, with some of the larger sharks, they're big and strong enough that even a test bite or an accidental hit can do a lot of damage.
We hear the statistics. It's so unlikely that someone will actually die from an attack by a shark. And George Burgess, you wrote recently in an opinion piece for CNN, having so many shark attacks take place so close in time and locale is extremely rare. But you said, still, you're more likely to die of a bicycle accident than an encounter with a shark. And yet, two young people lost parts of their arms, as you said, on Oak Island. Those are horrifying stories. Is the fear of serious and permanent injury irrational? Is that actual risk elevated right now, George Burgess?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at these things at two levels. You can look at them at the personal level. The individuals who got bit, it doesn't matter whether we call it a bite or an attack, you know, the injury they've got is severe, and they've got some big hurdles to jump over here for the rest of their life. And so our hearts go out to these people, you know, regardless of what you want to call it. So there's no irrationality involved with worrying about suffering a major injury. That's just being prepared and being vigilant. So we shouldn't be worried about that. What we do need to do, though, is also look at the big picture. And the big picture is last year in the entire world, there were only 3 fatalities associated with shark attack. So considering many millions, hundreds of millions of hours are spent in the sea worldwide, to only have 3 people walk in the water and not come back because of a shark pretty much puts it in perspective. Now, it doesn't make you feel any better if you're one of those 3, but the reality is that your odds of being attacked, far less dying, are almost infinitesimal. On the other hand, you can have situations like we've seen in North Carolina where you get the perfect storm of factors that are coming together that result in a situation where over that area in a shorter period of time, your odds are higher than usual. And that's what we've seen in North Carolina. The conditions are right. And so your chances of putting your foot in the water in North Carolina and getting bitten right now are higher than they were at this time a year ago. And probably higher than they will be next year at this time, because we won't necessarily have all this thing lining up the way it has. So in the end, this comes down to the fundamental point, which is when you enter the sea, you're entering a wilderness. It's a wilderness experience, and we're ecotourists every time we enter the sea. And as such, we need to remember that there's a certain amount of risk that we assume when we engage in a wilderness experience. And obviously for us, the greatest danger about aquatic recreation isn't sharks. It isn't drowning, which it takes thousands of people a year. It's riding the car to and from the beach. That's where we need to be most careful, because far more people are injured or killed in the cars going to or from the beach than drowning and shark attacks combined.
And once again, George Burgess, when was the last time a person died from a shark attack in North Carolina?
You know, I don't have that answer for you at the top of my head. Maybe our other guest has that, but it's been decades.
Yeah, I believe it was 2001 actually fatal shark incident in North Carolina.
That's right. That was off the Outer Banks. That's right.
It was in the Hatteras area.
And there were 2 people that suffered serious injury in that incident, and one woman wound up in the hospital, and her partner, I think, was...
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Yep.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about sharks. What's really out there to fear? How can you minimize your chances of a shark encounter? And what do we need to understand about these mysterious creatures? We have 2 well-respected shark experts to answer your questions today. George Burgess is the director of the Florida Program for Shark Research and the International Shark Attack File, both housed at the University of Florida's Museum of Natural History. And Chuck Bangley, shark researcher at East Carolina University, is with us in the studio. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. Chuck Bangley, why do we care, taking a look at this from a conservationist point of view, why do we care about protecting sharks?
So sharks are, as top predators, they actually occupy a pretty important cog in the food web. Some of the research I'm doing is actually looking at how often they occur in certain habitat types. The eventual goal with that is to see whether or not habitats that are regularly patrolled by sharks, through kind of trickle-down effects through the food chain, end up actually being better habitats for juvenile fishes like red drum or flounder or spotted sea trout. And the reason for this is that sharks will actually scare off the predators of these juvenile fish. So most of these fish are too small for a large coastal shark to really pay attention to. But they will eat things like bluefish and bottlenose dolphins that are in there trying to feed on the juvenile fish. So an area that's regularly patrolled by sharks may actually be a healthier fish nursery. And that can actually lead to increased numbers of these fish species that end up on our own plates.
We have a follow-up tweet from Sarah Finn. She says, thanks for addressing on the air. I would argue it does matter what we call the interaction. It has a direct effect on public opinion and fear. And she says, I've been bah humbugged by George Burgess. If you'd like to ask a question of our shark experts, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. Send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. And we've seen, of course, this is Shark Week on the Discovery Channel, which probably has something to do with getting more mileage out of the recent shark incident headlines. Is it true that sharks can be playful? And I'm thinking about great white sharks and a documentary footage showing a person who tries to engage with them from a boat and then will jump in the water and actually develop some kind of rapport. And Chuck Bangley is looking at me with furrowed brows going, I'm not sure what you're talking about. Does that sound at all plausible to either of you?
It doesn't seem like a great idea. I mean, these are fairly intelligent animals. There have been some people who have they have a brain to body size ratio that's more similar to mammals than it is to other fish. And some people have speculated that they may be as intelligent as house cats or dogs. I've actually done a captive feeding study with spiny dogfish sharks, which are a smaller species, but they're very social. They occur in large schools. And over the course of keeping them captive in this tank, they kind of got used to me. And it reached a point where they would kind of expect the food from me. They'd look out of the water at me and stuff. But I would not recommend trying to kind of befriend a larger shark. And even with the spiny dogfish, I mean, that wasn't a relationship that I sought out. and I'm not sure it was actually there. I think they just got more comfortable with me.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We have two shark experts today answering your questions. If you'd like to ask George Burgess of the International Shark Attack File a question or Chuck Bangley, shark researcher at ECU, a question, give us a call, 910-343-1138. We'll take a short break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. And with me in the studio, once again, shark researcher Chuck Bangley, and with us by phone, the director of the Florida Program for Shark Research and the International Shark Attack File, George Burgess. If you'd like to ask a question of our experts, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at coastlinehqr. And we have Bud from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering about the commercial fishing, the impact. North Carolina allows commercial fishing up close to shore, and the food supply for the sharks. Is that a factor in that they may attack because they're not able to get enough food?
That's a great question. Chuck Bangley.
Yeah, certainly the sharks will follow around sources of food, and you'll see sharks actually you'll see groups of particularly blacktip sharks, but sometimes bulls or other large species will be mixed in there. But they'll follow around the shrimp trawlers and wait for the shrimp trawlers to basically unload their bycatch. As far as prey species availability, it really depends on the species you're talking about. Some of their prey species are doing better than others. The most recent stock assessment for menhaden, for example, which is a bait fish that just about everything in the ocean eats. And it's also a very important source of food for a lot of our shark species here. That was recently assessed as not being overfished. But then there are other species that, have been demonstrably in decline. And we have other things like sea turtles that are food for some of the larger shark species that have, some of those sea turtle species are actually showing signs of recovery from previous declines. So it really depends on what prey species you're looking for, but most of our sharks here are generalists, so they can usually switch to whatever is the most common prey available.
Bud, thanks so much for your call. Governor McCrory, just before the holiday weekend got underway, he announced his intention to look for patterns among these 8 incidents that we've seen during this season. And this is what he said.
There doesn't seem to be any one specific spot where it's happening. I do believe that each local beach has its own unique circumstances. I am going to be talking with my Secretary of Public Safety to see if there is any one-fit-all approach to dealing with this issue. I doubt there is, because each circumstance is so different. I have talked to several state legislators where the initial bites occurred, where to talk about potential local restrictions, where they might be, for example, dumping off potential feed for sharks, which bring sharks in and around areas where there is people swimming, especially during high tourism season during the summertime. And I think that has to be considered. But again, it might be more of each local responsibility to make that decision. But I am reviewing also with our public safety personnel to make sure that we have the personnel in place to respond to any potential emergency or action that has to be taken.
And that audio comes to us courtesy of ABC News in Durham. We asked for further information about Governor McCrory's plan, and at this point, the Department of Public Safety said North Carolina Emergency Management has been tracking the large number of shark attacks along the coast in its capacity as a coordinator of statewide emergency-related assets and a leader of the state emergency response team. They stand prepared to respond for potential requests by counties for resources and assistance. So it sounds like that may still be in the development stage in terms of response. But what about what McCrory has said and what Bud had started to raise? He asked about commercial fishing. But what about the fishermen, fisher people who stand on piers and dump bait into the water or dump guts? You know, they clean their fish on the piers and essentially chum the waters. Is that an issue that should be paid closer attention to?
You certainly want to. I mean, the fishing piers have been there for a long time. Some of these fishing piers have been there for decades, and in some cases there's been a pier on that site for over a century. So that's certainly enough time for the local sharks to figure out that this is a place to get a good cheap meal. At the same time, because those piers have been there for so long, it's hard to pin just the increased number of shark bites on those. But certainly if you're out there swimming, you want to steer well away from these fishing piers. I go out there and fish on them sometimes, and there's definitely a population of sharks at each one that hangs out near the cleaning station where people fillet their fish and throw their remains overboard. And some of these sharks can be fairly large. I did see an 8-foot shark at one of them one time.
And what kind of shark might that have been?
That actually, it looked like a dusky when I saw it. And then a week later, somebody fishing from the shore pulled it in and tagged it and released it. And that's actually relatively unusual for an adult dusky shark to be that close to shore. So clearly it had acclimated to this kind of easy food source. But at the same time, I've also been out fishing at a pier and watched a surfer literally check off all the boxes to lead to a shark bite and not get hit. He was in there surfing next to the pier. These piers do create surf breaks that surfers enjoy. He was surfing next to the pier as the sun was going down near the bait cleaning station. There were actually blacktip sharks near him. You could see the fins come up. And so he was just about doing everything he could to get bitten and paddled back into shore completely unscathed. I was actually genuinely worried about this kid, but he made it out.
George Burgess, do you think having fishermen dumping guts off a pier is a public safety issue if there are swimmers nearby? Is that something that should be addressed by public policy?
I think it needs to be addressed by public policy, but with the full understanding that the ocean along shorelines are multi-use facilities. There's good arguments to be made that there's multiple user groups that want access to that. I mean, you don't want people surfing in the middle of a bunch of kids in the surf. So, you know, the surfers need to move over to a place where they're independent of the waders and the bathers. The fishermen need to do the same. And so I think the point is that the communities are going to have to make some fishing zones versus some bathing zones, and there's going to have to be some sort of a demilitarized zone between the two groups to keep them apart, and then we can, you know, reduce the chances of of attracted sharks to the fishing facilities wandering into the other areas. All that said, that requires on-beach personnel. And so one of the things that has struck me as a former resident of North Carolina a long time ago, 40 years ago, and what I have seen in recent years is that there's not a lot of lifeguards on the beaches. And as North Carolina has grown as a tourist destination or a holiday destination, obviously there's been an economic upturn to the local communities because of those people coming in. I think now is the time that those communities are going to have to start putting some of that tourist money back into infrastructure and personnel, and that means they're going to have to start getting some beach safety personnel, lifeguards on the beaches.
Okay, we have a few more calls coming in. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about sharks with shark experts George Burgess and Chuck Bangley. And Michael from Sunset Beach, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Know, about 3 weeks before all the shark attacks or shark bites happened, we were on the beach in Sunset Beach, and my friend was coming, he was riding a wave in, and two sharks were beside him riding the same wave. And he said that they didn't do anything. They just were riding the wave like he was, and then he, of course, came in horrified. And and he said they were about 4 feet. And anyway, there were hundreds of people in the water, and I didn't know what to do. So what we did is we called 911. We met the police on the pier, on the Sunset Beach pier. And as I was kind of telling the cop about the sharks, a fisherman there who fished regularly said that there are thousands of sharks in the waters around here in May and June, and that they're non-aggressive sharks. And he says they're from the pier. You can see them brush up against people and swim by them, and the people have no idea that they're there. He said, but they're there regularly, and there's also stingrays in the water, which I actually saw the following week. And I was just wondering whether, in fact, that was true, because I was pretty horrified when he said that there's thousands, and I knew nothing about it.
And this is something that I've heard, too. George Burgess, Chuck Bangley, is it true that were we to fly over in a helicopter, what would we see?
If the water
sharks,
was...
You see sharks every day, as a matter of fact, and you could go out right at this very moment on beaches from North Carolina down to Florida, and you'll see sharks swimming in and among the beach users. Talk to anybody who, pulls one of those suntan lotion signs or bar signs up and down the beach, and they'll tell you they see this all the time. I'll tell you a story. One time I took some media folks up to see just that. They wanted some video here in North Carolina, in Florida, and I was telling them, look down there, and sure enough, there's the sharks, and they were videoing it. And as we went low in this helicopter, some of the surfers there, being young and as they might be in the surfer community, felt obliged to give us the single finger salute from down below. And as they were doing their single finger salute to the helicopter, a tiger shark about 10 feet in size was swimming inside of them closer to the beach. And the video guys got the picture of both happening. So they had no idea that there was a big tiger shark there. The fact of the matter is most sharks are not interested in human beings as food. The black tips and spinners, which are so common in the surf zone in the Carolinas, are fish-eating sharks. The humans aren't on the menu. We're not part of the food chain. And so we all have encounters with them. We've all been within 10 feet of a shark at some time in our life without knowing it. That's par for the course. And, of course, the more fishes there are in the water, more schooling fishes, the more sharks there are going to be. And, of course, during those time periods, that's when some of these mistaken identity attacks can occur, where a black tip might grab at a splash thinking it's a food fish and it's your foot. And we call these hit-and-run attacks. They're quick grabs and let goes, no Jaws themes music in the background. They disappear, and it results in either puncture wounds or small lacerations, and these are properly called shark bites because the injuries are not so severe. But unfortunately, we have some bigger ones as well.
And let's talk to Michael from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I believe one of the guys that was attacked last week was right in front of the lifeguard stand.
That would have been off Ocracoke, I think.
That's correct. Is it possible, I've heard somebody mention this outside of your show, to the beach patrols to have these drones that can fly up and down the beach, and at least when you got a really crowded beach season, you can get the people out of the water when one's close. But would that be an option as opposed to a helicopter, I suppose?
That's an interesting question, Michael. Thanks for your call. Chuck Bangley, as George just explained, there are these sharks that are around us all the time. So if a drone was flying up and down the beach, is there a way to do that without generating constant hysteria?
They've been testing that out on the West Coast, looking for white sharks off of the surf beaches there. The tough call here on the East Coast, where we have so many of these smaller black tip and spinner sharks, is kind of differentiating when it's worth warning the people in the water and when it's just going to be a shark that's just going to cruise by. And 99.9% of the time, even the very large aggressive sharks have no interest in people and they're just going to swim on by. So the drones are definitely useful for getting an idea of how many sharks are there in the area. You probably have to have somebody on hand to make the call whether or not it's worth pulling people out of the water.
We had a question. We lost Wes from Wilmington, but he left a question based on this pattern of bites. Could this be the same shark, George Burgess? Do you think that's likely?
Yeah, that's always the question in these things when you have attacks occurring in the same geographic region over a short period of time. And had you asked that question, 5 years ago to me, I would have said, you know, almost surely no. But we investigated a shark situation in Egypt a few years ago where we could definitively tie two or three bites to the same shark. And so we know it does happen. In my 40 years of study of shark attack, I've only seen two occasions where I think that a single shark might have been involved in multiple bites. And then, of course, was aware of a third one. The famous series of attacks in 1916 off of the New Jersey coast, which appeared to be the result of a single white shark. But other than that, most of the times this is more likely pinned on a variety of individuals that just happened to be in the area at the same time.
Okay, we have an email. Robert writes, are sharks attracted to urine and feces? And George Burgess, you actually said earlier that sharks are attracted to every human fluid that could come out of just about any part of the human body. So that would be a yes, right?
I think that's pretty much a yes. We haven't done tests, and we talked earlier about menstruating women. Well, I haven't got any volunteers that have stepped forward to say I'm going to walk out in the water and we'll do good statistical tests on this. But I think it's pretty obvious that the shark brain, which is pretty big. But most of the brain is dedicated to senses, and the biggest lobe of the brain is the olfactory lobe, one that goes for smell and taste. So that's what they do particularly well, and so no doubt they can sense anything that's coming out of any orifice.
Okay, and quickly, we just have about a minute and a half left. If your immediate family was staying at the North Carolina beach this summer, what would you tell them, Chuck Bangley?
I tell them steer clear of the piers and other fishing activity. Fishing activity, it puts bait in the water, and it also creates struggling fish on the end of the lines, and those are both attractive to sharks. Also, keep an eye out for shark food. Look for large schools of fish moving up and down the beach. You can recognize them as kind of a dark mass when it's clear or ripples in the water. And if there are birds diving on those schools of fish, steer clear of it because that means something's hitting those fish from below and you don't want to find out if it's a shark.
George Burgess, quick, your final thought.
I have no problem going into North Carolina waters with the consideration, of course, that at certain places and certain times, if shark attacks have occurred, we want to be extra vigilant. And so, that would be my thoughts.
That's this edition of Coastline. Thanks to our guests, George Burgess and Chuck Bangley. Thanks to you, our listeners, and those of you who emailed and tweeted your comments. Coastline is produced by Isabel Shepherd. Our technical director is Ken Campbell. Our web wizard is Melissa Stone. If you missed this show, we'll post it on our website, whqr.org, later today, and you can download the podcast from iTunes. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.